we consider this list of names, the first, of course, is Benjamin. So this individual was a descendant of the tribe of Benjamin, which is a son headed south to the Sea of Gentiles. And the first individual along the family tree was Kish, which is one who is crooked and lures into a trap. But during the break, Kirk, you mentioned that as you studied Kish, it's also to bring together and control, which is precisely the nature of religion. In fact, religion is based upon the Latin religon. Ligon is a ligament, and it is to reattach. So it binds the joins and points together. So the very definition of religion is to rebind,
correct,
to control, to create a mechanism which binds people in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
the two uses I found was like to bring together. They were referring to two things. One of them was fruit and grain, mm-hmm. where you bring it together and you press the grain or together. So you're bringing it together. And they also say the same thing is to bring together and press or bind people. I mean,
yeah.
Well, gosh. I don't mean to laugh. It's kind of,
I know. But
I don't mean to laugh like it's funny. Just laugh like how.
Right. And the next one was Abiel, which is my father is the Canaanite god, El.
Right.
And then we moved on to Saror, which is one who besieges and binds, speaking also of religion, as an adversary. So this would be satanic religion,
right,
prescribing drugs and therefore specifically addressing Christianity.
There was a couple of cool things, related things, I should say, about this that I found from some ancient type of lexicons from old roots and things. It's a group of things fastened together for ease of handling. Well,
okay.
That's pretty good for government. Something bound up tightly. And it's also like to saw from the word is a hard pebble or flint or a small stone or at least of the piece of grain. A small piece of grain. So once again, we have this, the small, we have the pressing together, we have handling of people, controlling them, we have tightly bound, and then we have, once again, a reference to small.
Right. And we have, of course, adversary, vex, and show hostility, and those are relevant here because Paul admitted that his ego was so out of control. And ego is usually out of control for a very insecure individual, that Satan had to demon-possess him to control his ego. Satan is the adversary. So Paul, being demon-possessed, was in league with the adversary. Prescribing drugs is relevant because the basis of the Greek word that has become Christ and Christian means to apply drugs. So he's speaking directly of the birth of Christianity. As it relates to vexing and hostility, we should also be aware that not only was Paul extraordinarily hostile to Yahweh and to his Torah, he was also at war with, I mean, unbelievably hostile to, condemning the disciples of Yahusha, specifically Shimon Kephish, Peter, and Yohanan, John, and Jacob, James.
Let me toss one other goodie in here. It's also a bundle, a parcel, a pouch, a bag, or a purse. Purses carry money, and Yahusha told his disciples, don't carry a purse to collect money in like the priests do.
Right.
Yet without that, Paul has nothing because he's always asking for money.
Yeah.
As is Christianity.
Correct. The next name in the list is Baccarath. And Baccarath was originally challenging for me, probably the hardest of these initially, because of my just kind of knee-jerk cursory response, because I know that it is based upon Bakar, and Bakar means firstborn son. So Bakar speaks of firstborn. So a Baccarath would be a firstborn son is what most people would define it as. But as you really examine the word's etymology, what you find is that a more accurate and telling definition of Baccarath is one who laments the birthright,
mm-hmm.
one who's the first to cry and complain. And it's from Bakaroth, Bakar, and Bakoth, which is firstborn to wail and lament, offspring of weeping bitterly. Now, why the primary definition is so important here, one who laments the birthright, one who complains against, one who is opposed to, one who is jealous of the birthright.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the birthright? Israel is are the chosen people,
all right.
And they were the first that were offered the covenant and inheriting all that Yahweh has to give, including the land and adoption into his family, participation in his family, is the birthright.
Right.
And so what did Paul do? He annulled the old covenant.
Right.
And he created a new covenant with a different birthright for a different group of people. And so Paul is the epitome of annulling the birthright and lamenting the birthright of Israel. So that you could not pick a more appealing name to describe someone who did what Paul did.
No, it's perfect.
Yeah. The next name is Afyak. Afyak is, I breathe that which breaks and ensnares in flaming souls. I am the source of breath. I am the source of souls from Puak, to blow hard, to blast away, to snare, to break with one's breath. Well, the thing that Paul broke with his words was the Torah and his covenant.
Mm-hmm. That's what I got, yeah.
That's what he did. And just think of the souls that were ensnared by those inflamed words, demeaning, breaking the covenant. Breaking, you know, tearing apart the Torah.
And I also got a link to Puwak on that, which is to be puffed up.
Yeah, puffed up in the sense of arrogance, which was the hallmark, yeah, of Paul. So an individual, so this is Afyak, an individual son going south. Well, this was Ben, and then it was so this was not Benjamin, but Ben, and then the verb form of Yamini, which is from Yamen, which is, so the actual verb was Yamini, from Yamen, to veer right, going south. From Yam, sea, meaning Gentiles, a mighty and strong man, which is so this individual is going to be a mighty and strong man going south. Now, Paul claimed to be a vicious man who pummeled his adversaries, and here he says this is going to be an individual going south who starts off as a mighty, strong, vicious man. Now, where did Paul begin life? North or south of Israel?
He was north of Israel.
Yeah. It was Paul of Tarsus, which is up there in what is Turkey today. He headed south, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when the disciples called him into Jerusalem saying, come on, pal, you're speaking out against circumcision, and circumcision is a sign of the covenant, you can't claim to be speaking for the God of the Torah and condemn circumcision. I mean, that's like saying I'm speaking for the God of the Torah and I'm the God of the Torah, but I'm annulling this Torah. I'm speaking for the God who offered the covenant, and I'm breaking that covenant. You know, you can't be against circumcision and speak for the God. But he was brought into Jerusalem, and he had to come south to do that. So he was an individual who prevails through his own size and strength, his own power, and his own political and military authority. And that's what Paul did initially, a mighty and strong man going south. a man of wealth and twisted capabilities, politically and militarily, who gives birth to anguish and suffering. This is Chol. That's not a very inspiring list of names to come from, is it?
No. It's amazing, those words, in light of what we know of Paul.
Yeah.
I mean,
and you know, you have to say, is there any reason that a sane God would provide a list of names like this unless it was for a specific purpose? And could there be any other purpose in this name, in this list of names?
Zero.
Other than coming to understand the derivative of all of this, which is the founder of the Christian religion.
Doesn't you know, the last name, Apioch, which is Poach, it was the related word to that, which words was also, I found, was words that grow a wall around sheep, and actually it's the sheep being a metaphor for the And then you go to Chabuk, and doesn't Yah tell Chabuk to wait for this man who, with his inflammatory words, that he will surely come, and basically described him doing the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, you can't have this many connections, and, I mean, this ain't, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes here.
You know, you don't, but you have to have the same approach that Sherlock Holmes had, which is, Sherlock Holmes, I mean, the whole myth of Sherlock Holmes,
yes,
extraordinarily observant.
Right.
Okay, that's his number one skill set, is he was observant. You want to understand what God's saying, you have to be extraordinarily observant. You've got to notice and look for and notice all of the little details. And then the next thing that made Sherlock Holmes, the myth of Sherlock Holmes, so impressive, is that he knew how to make connections. He knew what was right and what was wrong in the scene, and could deduce conclusions from the evidence. So he processed what he saw, he closely considered what he saw, carefully considered what he saw, and was able to draw connections based on this. If you don't apply those two skill sets, the Sherlock Holmes skill sets, to go from being very observant to drawing conclusions that produce understanding, then nothing God says is going to have any value.
True.
I'm just finished moments before the program began, looking at a combination of nouns that were strung together in Yahweh's conclusion of his fatherly advice to his son about religion and politics. And the two words specifically said that those who chase after, who pursue, who are counted among the religious, that they lose the ability to exercise good judgment. They lack the ability to be rational and reasonable. And I think that's precisely what's being said here.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if you lack the ability to be rational and reasonable, all of the evidence that we're considering here is not going to mean anything to you.
And obviously there's a lot of them, because I don't know how many people collectively, the whole family consisting of those today, have talked to, and it just falls on deaf ears. Even when they know there's something to it, they just walk away like,
Yeah.
Exactly. By that.
It is. And God is saying it's the first and most egregious influence of religion, is that no amount of evidence or reason does the religious individual any good, because they lack the ability to process it. All right, so this mighty strong man who is going south to capitalize politically and militarily to give birth to anguish and suffering. And in this regard, he had a son whose name was Shaul.
Shaul.
Shaul means to question him. It is from Sha'al, which is, Sha'al means to question. It's written identically, Shaul, to what other word in Hebrew?
Sheol.
Sheol. And what is Sheol?
Sheol is a place of separation from Yahweh.
Yeah.
Not a good choice of names.
The realm of dead souls were questioned and then eternally separated from God. The place of no return, of absolute abandonment, of punishment, of continuous, a place that is, I'm not going to say better known, more commonly known as hell. And so that was the man's name. That is also the given name of the wannabe self-proclaimed apostle that founded Christianity, that authored half of its New Testament, Shaul. And he said that this is what is so fascinating. He said that, and in this regard, he had a son whose name was Shaul, a good, generous, beautiful, and pleasing young man who was preferred as a fighter. Now, it is fascinating to me. In fact, I was thrilled to read that this man that Yahweh had just said would plunder the Israelites, take advantage of them in every possible way, deceive them, plot against them, rob them of their sons, of their productivity, of their very lives, that he was good.
Yeah.
You're familiar with Dode?
Yeah, very much so.
Was Dode good?
No.
Was Dode right with God?
Absolutely.
Is Dode considered righteous?
Absolutely, by Yahweh.
Of all the people that have come along life's way, who is the person that God says that he loves the most?
Dode.
Dode. So Dode was not good, and yet he is the most loved by Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
This fellow was good, and God just went through a chapter of assailing him, saying how much he hates him.
All right.
So that gets us to a really important thing. You know, I went out on a limb about a year ago. It's something that really resonated with Larry, who we'll do this evening show with, where I said, I'd much rather be right than good. And that the more that I study the Torah, the more I've come to realize that being right is essential, being good is not.
No.
And here is a perfect example. This person was called good, who was extraordinarily wrong as it relates to Yahweh. Dead wrong. And the person who was bad, decidedly not good, Dode, is considered righteous with Yahweh. Because he was right when it comes to the Torah, to the covenant, to how to observe one and how to engage in the other.
Yeah. And even in your translation here, same as I got, is you know, it is the one they chose. They preferred him.
Yeah.
They preferred the man that was called good, but it was never, ever referred to as righteous.
Yeah, he was Bakur, an adult male who was a fighting man with strength and ability as a soldier. That is the one that they preferred. But, you know, clearly here, he was good, generous, beautiful, and pleasing. Now, all the things that man seeks, you know, he was a generous man. Wasn't that lovely? He was a good man. Oh, boy. He was a beautiful man. He was a pleasing man, handsome and desirable, prosperous and charitable, values-oriented with all the proper characteristics to perform the expected functions.
Well, doesn't that relate to you to Dode's son who ran off to the Benjamites, you know, at a time to do something? I mean, trying to settle some old scores and that, or remember when the Benjamites hated the fact that Jerusalem was picked and that Dode was there. And, you know, when you start reading that story between David and his son, who eventually, Absalom, who eventually gets killed, isn't it the same thing? I mean, they just,
I mean, the bottom line is that Benjamin was the smallest and least desirable of all of the regions given to any one of the 12 tribes. And so it was in itself lowly and little.
Right.
So it says, and there was not an individual among the children of Yisrael who was more good than him, who was more generous, beautiful, or pleasing than him, more handsome, desirable, or prosperous than him, more charitable than him, who did more good deeds or made people feel better than him. From his shoulders and above, however, he was grievously defiant and treacherously unfaithful. He was wa'ma'al, hard to understand, conceited, haughty, and improper, more so than any of the people. Now, this the second part of this, the reality is that that virtually every English Bible says that from his shoulders and above, he was taller than any of his people.
Right.
Well, you know, if from your shoulders and above, if you're taller than anybody, that would mean you'd have a long neck. We get our height. You know, Shaquille O'Neal's a lot bigger than I am. But it's because his legs and his body are taller than... It's his size from the neck down that we differ.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a bigger head than I do, than I have. You know, we're not calling this guy a pencil neck. I mean, if he had a really long neck, he'd be really vulnerable in battle.
In battle, yes.
Yeah, he'd be he would be unattractive.
Yeah.
So when we read this from his shoulders and above, he was, and then you have to translate ma'al. While a tertiary definition of ma'al can mean higher, and therefore you could extrapolate taller, I guess. It really means ma'al is, you know, it's like where we get malevolent, malignant. And he manifests the highest level of sin, transgression and falsehood, trespass and adultery, and displayed exceedingly substantial violations of the standards, incurring the resulting guilt. So in terms of his conduct among men, he was one righteous dude. In terms of his conduct, his thinking regarding God, it was a disaster. And that's what this is saying. It's comparing the impression he makes among men versus the impression that he makes with God. Which one do you think matters in the end?
Well, the one between God and me matters more than anything else.
Yeah, exactly. And there's where Shaul failed, both of them.
Right, all the Shauls.
Right. It also says he was hard to understand, conceited and haughty and improper. Gaboa, proud and arrogant, self-serving, self-exalting, devoted to eagerly and zealously, albeit improperly, seeking and claiming a high, powerful, and official status. Boy, if that doesn't scream
Paul, I don't know.
Paul, yeah.
I don't know enough about Shaul the king to draw out that many, but it certainly is what it means, and she's got to be referring to Paul more than the king.
Yeah. There is absolutely no chance whatsoever that this applies to at least the last part of it to Shaul. It didn't do us any good if it were, even if it were true, it doesn't do us any good to know it.
No.
But it absolutely appeals to Shaul, who became Paul. Now, we began talking a little bit about Benjamin from Rachel's perspective.
Okay.
So let's turn to the Torah. Rachel foreshadows the prophetic implications of Benjamin. And we're going to go through all of these names. We may not get them all in this program. We're going to go through all of this and deduce as much raw understanding as we possibly can from it. But the single most important is, let's ferret out what Benjamin means. Because Paul, not once but twice, proudly boasted that he was a Benjamite. And God had a lot to say about the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, prophetic implications of Benjamin and thus of Shaul. This is recorded for our benefit. I'm going to tell you again, Kirk, and this is something you know, but there is no reason, you can't come up with any reason whatsoever that what I'm going to read to you now was provided for our elucidation, other than to foreshadow the founder of the Christian religion. Because even if you were to extrapolate and say, oh, I'm trying to foreshadow the nature of King Shaul, well, God himself laid out everything that King Shaul was going to do and right in their presence, and they ignored it all. So defining the nature of Benjamin would be meaningless to them.
Right, because they had already picked him.
But for, and he, limited number of people for a limited amount of time, but Shaul, the founder of the Christian religion, we're talking about tens of billions of souls. We're talking about someone who has infected people for 2,000 years. This is big prey now.
Right.
And so there's only one reason that God would bother to tell us this story, to warn us about the man that God hates most in all of human history. I mean, I have asked to be at two trials. I really want to be at two trials. Now, there's a few more I'd like to be at, but there's two, and maybe it's really three, because I really dislike Hadrian. But the two trials, because I know Muhammad pretty well, I'd like to be at Muhammad's trial, but I really want to be at Paul's trial. I despise Paul. And so it's going to be tough to wiggle my way in, because God's got so much against him already slated for his trial. So this begins. So they set out, and this is now speaking of Rachel and Jacob. So they set out and pulled away from Bethel, the home and family of God. Then it came to exist now and would repeat after a duration of time. When they were a particular distance away, the land they were approaching and entering, Ephrathah. And then it was when Rachel went into labor and gave birth. But in her labor and childbirth, she experienced great distress and opposition. So when he became stubborn and unyielding, in confusing, confrontational, and obstinate opposition during labor and childbirth, she said to the one helping her give birth, "You should choose never to respect this one, because indeed another son is for you." And it was with her soul that indeed she was dying. So she, this is Rachel, called out, "Ben Oni, my son of unrighteousness, my son of idolatry, my son of iniquity, my son who exalts himself in vain." But his father summoned him as Benjamin, son turning south to the sea of Gentiles. Okay, so let's go through this, because this is all prophetic of the wolf in sheep's clothing that would tear people away from the Torah, according to Yosha. Yosha didn't use that metaphor casually. He is, when it comes to making words sing, God's really adept.
Mm-hmm.
So they set out and pulled away from Bethel, the home and family of God. So the thing that they were leaving was the home and family of God. Yeah, they're leaving. They're walking away from the covenant. Yeah, this kid was born estranged from, walking away from the house of God.
Right.
He wasn't born in the house of God. He wasn't born approaching the house of God. He was born walking away from the house of God at a considerable distance. Oh, so that's
significant.
Then it came to exist now and would repeat after a duration of time. Ode. It came to exist beyond this point and subsequently. Speaking of something that would be repeated occurring again, and now bearing witness to it.
Clue.
Now, you think that's a clue?
I think so. That
as we're walking away from the house of God, there's something that was going to occur and then would repeat again after a duration of time. Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
With
indeed.
Shaul, the wannabe self-proclaimed apostle and author of the Christian New Testament. When they were, which is, by the way, walking away from Bethel, the home and family of God.
Remember?
Right. Absolutely.
Right. Going to go to the
walking to Paul's new covenant, his New Testament. When they were at a particular distance, we'll look at Kibroth and then consider the Lamb.